Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, so this evening we will take for a study sutta number 5 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called Anangana Sutta. The word Angana means a blemish, a defect. And so Anangana means without blemishes, without defects. And this sutta is spoken not by the Buddha himself, but by Venerable Sariputta. Okay, so Sariputta begins by addressing the monks. And he says, friends, there are these four kinds of persons found existing in the world. This is a kind of format that one finds very often in the Anguttara Nikaya, which is constructed according to a numerical scheme. And so one finds many suttas opening with the statement, there are these four kinds of persons found existing in the world. But here, this sutta has been classified in the Majjhima Nikaya. Is the Yahang Jing version, is it in the Yahang Jing? It's in the Zhe Yahang Jing, not the Zhong Yahang Jing. It's in the Zhong Yahang Jing. Okay, it's also in the Chinese Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, so what are the four kinds of persons? Okay, and this is a message here that's very important to understand. Okay, there's a person, one person has a blemish, a defect, and he does not understand, as it actually is, that I have a blemish in myself. And then there's another person, a second person, is one with a blemish who understands as it really is, I have a blemish in myself. The third person is one who has no blemish but does not understand as it actually is, I have no blemish in myself. And then the fourth person is one who has no blemish within himself, and he understands as it really is, I have no blemish in myself. So we could list these four. Okay, so now, having sort of set up this scheme of four persons, Sariputta makes an evaluation of them. He sort of ranks them comparatively. First, we take the person with a blemish, and then in that category, we take the one who doesn't recognize that he has a blemish in himself. And the Buddha says that this is the inferior of the two persons with a blemish. But the person with a blemish who understands as it really is that I have a blemish in myself is the superior of these two persons. Okay, then we take the type of person without a blemish, and again, they're ranked in an order of superiority. The one without a blemish who does not understand, I have no blemish in myself, this is the inferior of those two persons. And then the person with no blemish who understands that he has no blemish, this is called the superior of these two persons without blemish. One might think that it's proper that if one has no faults or blemishes, that one shouldn't recognize this, but one should just be completely nonchalant about it. But Sariputta says that it's better if one has no blemishes to be aware of this, not to be nonchalant about it. Okay, so when Sariputta makes this statement, then Venerable Mahamoggallana asks for the reasons behind these evaluations. He says, what is the cause and reason why of the two persons with a blemish, one is called the inferior and the other is called superior? And what is the reason why of the two persons with no blemish, one is inferior and the other is superior? Okay, so now Sariputta gives the explanation why. Okay, when a person with a blemish does not recognize the blemish in himself, then that person will not arouse any effort to make any effort to eliminate that blemish. But instead, the person just goes on living with the blemish, with the mental defect, and he will act in ways which are motivated by that blemish of character. And this will cause the blemish to grow bigger and stronger. And this will happen through the whole course of the person's life. And so when death comes, that person will die with a defiled mind, with a mind which is defiled by lust, hatred, and delusion. Okay, then Sariputta illustrates this with a very picturesque simile. It's suppose that somebody buys a bronze dish, a serving dish, from a shop, from some kind of a utility shop, and the dish is covered with dirt and stains. Then after buying it, the owner doesn't clean it, doesn't polish it, but just leaves it as it is, dirty and stained, and then puts it away someplace in a dusty area. So what is going to happen to that bronze dish? Is it going to get clean by itself? What happens if we don't clean it and you put it away in a dirty place? Then the bronze dish gets more and more dirty, dirtier, and the stains increase and become more pronounced. And so it's just like a person with a blemish who doesn't recognize the blemish and therefore doesn't make any effort to remove it. If we have states of greed, hatred, ignorance, and we don't recognize them, then those states of greed, hatred, and ignorance will remain, and they will just gain momentum, become more prominent parts of our character, of our mental makeup. And then when death comes, they will carry through into the next life, and any unwholesome karma that's created through these unwholesome mental states will tend to lead us to a lower type of rebirth. But now the contrary case, we have a person with a blemish in the mind, person with any of the defilements. Here, the text only mentions greed, hatred, and delusion. But in other texts, we have, like the simile of the cloth, I think 16 mental defilements. In the Discourse on Effacement, Sutta number 8, there are about 44 faults or blemishes. So it's useful to examine oneself against these lists of defilements and mental blemishes. Okay, so if one has a blemish in oneself, and then one recognizes that this blemish is present, then one will make the effort, or generally one will make the effort to overcome and eliminate that blemish. So what's taking place here in terms of the practice of the Buddha's path, we can say that this is a combination of right mindfulness and right effort. One aspect of samasati, of right mindfulness, is mindfulness of one's states of mind, of one's mental qualities. And so when one is mindful of the state of mind, then one is aware if there's a state of greed arisen, one recognizes that greed has arisen. If hatred arises, one recognizes hatred or anger have arisen. If the mind is dull and unwieldy, then one recognizes delusion is present. Okay, so the important point, whether one has blemishes or not, but the important point is when one does have a blemish, that one recognizes it and is able to identify, these are my blemishes, these are my faults. And then one makes the effort. Here we have right effort coming into play. One makes the effort, one arouses the energy to abandon that blemish, to overcome that defilement. And there are many methods spoken of in the text for overcoming defilements. But the first method that one can be used is simply to recognize the blemish or the defilement as a blemish, and then just with a push of one's mental energy, one cuts off, tries to cut off that unwholesome stream of thought. If that doesn't work effectively, then one can sometimes use a direct antidote to these particular mental blemishes. For example, if there's a lot of greed, then one reflects on the impermanence of the things that one is becoming attached to. And if one reflects on their impermanence, then one will see that there's no reason to become strongly attached to them. That the more one grasps onto them, the more one is paving the way for one's future suffering if one loses the object to which one is attached. If there's a lot of hatred and anger in the mind, then one can use the systematic development of metta meditation, loving kindness meditation, to gradually weaken and overcome hatred and anger. And to overcome delusion, one has to develop insight, the wisdom of insight. This sutta doesn't explain in any detail the methods for counteracting these defilements, but it just speaks about arousing one's desire and making an effort to eliminate these blemishes. And then the consequence, the result of removing the blemishes, is that when death comes, one will die with an undefiled mind, a mind that's not corroded by lust, hatred, and delusion. Okay, then Sariputta illustrates this again with a fitting simile. It's just the counterpart of the previous simile. Here, somebody goes to a shop and buys a bronze dish serving food, and the dish is probably a store where they sell used utensils. And so he buys a dish that looks like it has potential, but it's dirty, it has stains. But still, he takes it home, and then he cleans it very vigorously, thoroughly, and he keeps it in a well-protected place, not putting it just in a dirty corner. And so when he cleans and polishes that serving dish, the dish becomes cleaner and brighter. And since he's always storing it in a clean place, it will not tend to get dusty and dirty so easily. And so this is in the same way that one develops and trains one's own mind. People are often concerned about cleaning and polishing their dishware, their cars. Every Sunday, at least one Sunday a week, you're supposed to go out and clean and polish the car. But people don't give so much attention to polishing the mind. Okay, so if one goes on examining oneself for one's faults and blemishes, and then makes the effort to remove those blemishes, then the mind becomes bright, strong, sharp, powerful, clear, luminous, and that will bring much happiness during one's life. And then when death comes, one can die peacefully with a mind that's not disturbed by defilements. Okay, now we come to the third type of person. This is a person who's said to be with no blemish, but who does not understand as it actually is, I have no blemish in myself. What has to be understood here by a person with no blemish, I think, is not a person who's fully perfected, who's completely eliminated the defilements. But this is a person who might have achieved a state in which the defilements have been removed from the mind to some extent. So he's experiencing some calm, peaceful, clear, and pure state. But we shouldn't understand that this person has eliminated the defilements. Otherwise, it would not be possible for the defilements to arise again. Okay, so this person does not recognize that he has no blemishes in himself. And then the text says it can be expected that this person will give attention to the sign of the beautiful. I think that Pali expression is a little obscure and somewhat difficult to translate. Yeah, I think the key word here is the word nimitta, which in this context, it might be simply translated as object rather than sign. It takes on the meaning of sign in the context of a meditation practice where it becomes a kind of image that arises through tranquility meditation. But in this passage, instead of translating it as sign, it might be more simply and more clearly translated simply as object. And then what's meant especially by a subhanimitta, a beautiful object, is a sensually attractive object. And usually this phrase or this expression signifies an object that will become fastened upon as a basis for the arising of sexual desire. Because this is part of a discourse given as a training for monks who are intent on overcoming and eliminating sexual desire. Okay, so if the person is not aware, doesn't recognize that he has no blemishes in himself, then the person can become somewhat heedless in his interaction with sensual objects. And so then this person's attention will fix upon some sensually enticing, sensually exciting object. And when this happens, then the text says, lust will infect or invade his mind. So the mind will become overrun by sensual desire. And when that happens, then it can give the opportunity for other defilements to arise. And so before long, all of them are parading through the mind, lust, hatred, and delusion. And so the person has gone from being one with no blemishes to one who's completely caught in the trap of lust, hatred, and delusion. And then those defilements will remain in that person, and the person will die with lust, hatred, and delusion. He'll die with a defiled mind. Again, we go back to the same simile. Here, the person buys a bronze dish from a shop. This is a new dish, which is bright and shiny, clean. But after they're using it time and time again, they don't put any special effort into cleaning the bronze dish. And so the dish starts to become stained, tainted. And then they take the dish and they store it in a dirty, dusty place. And so the bronze dish will accumulate dust, and then later on it becomes defiled and stained. So that illustrates the person who is without blemishes but doesn't recognize this, and therefore lets himself become heedless, and then picks up and accumulates more defilements. The fourth case is that of a person with no blemish, who recognizes that I have no blemish in myself. And so this person who recognizes that the mind is temporarily free from blemishes or defilements, when that person meets with sensually attractive objects, he won't allow his attention to fasten on that object, to become fascinated by it and absorbed by it. And in this way, lust doesn't infect the mind, and this person will die without lust, hatred, and delusion, with an undefiled mind. And this is illustrated by people go to a shop and they buy a bronze dish, which is clean and bright, and they use it whenever they use it. Afterwards, they wash it and clean it, and they put it away. They store it in a clean cupboard. And so as time goes on, the bronze dish will continue to be clean and bright. So even 5 years, 10 years later, you can still use that dish, and it will be just as bright and shiny as it was on the day that you bought it. Okay, so paragraph 8 just sums up the reason why this ranking is made between the two. One is inferior, and the other is superior. Okay, now Sariputta is going to give an elaboration of other ways we can understand what is meant by this word blemish. And first, he explains it in general ways, in a general way, as a term for what is called here the spheres of evil, unwholesome wishes, unwholesome desires, bad desires. Okay, and now, in case it's not clear exactly what's meant by these bad, unwholesome wishes, Sariputta is going to elaborate. And some of these explanations will be particularly relevant to the monastic life. But I think with a little imagination, you could also transpose these meanings into your own ordinary day-to-day life. Okay, we come to paragraph 10. There's a case of a monk who might have a wish, if I commit an offense, that is some transgression of the monastic rules, let the other monks not know that I have committed an offense. That is, one has done something wrong, and one tries to protect oneself, not allow others to find out about it. In that way, one wants to protect one's self-image, and one doesn't want to have one's faults, one's shortcomings, discovered by others. But then it happens that the monks find out that this monk has committed an offense, and probably they speak to him about it, and then he becomes angry and bitter, thinking that these other monks, they know that I've committed an offense. Okay, and so that anger and bitterness, this is what is called the blemish. But I think also the blemish is this desire, let others not find out any wrong that I've done. One sees this not only in monastic practices, but also in political campaigns. One is running against another, and the campaign committee of one candidate is always going into the background history of the other candidates, finding out what kind of fault that candidate might have committed in the past. Not even if he's committed some fault himself, but, your preacher preached that in his sermons. Why haven't you denounced him in public? Okay, the next case. Okay, the monk has committed an offense, and then he wishes, okay, if the few monks have found out about this, let them admonish me in private, not in the midst of the Sangha. Actually, usually what is usually done for most of the monastic rules, if a monk transgresses the rule, it doesn't have to be presented in front of the whole Sangha, but it's enough for the monk just to confess it to one other monk. But it might be if a monk is a particular troublemaker and he's continually trying to hide his transgressions, then some of the monks might think, we just can't let him go on behaving this way. We have to admonish him in front of the whole community. And so when they do that, then this monk becomes angry and bitter, and he becomes resentful towards all of the monks for admonishing him in public. Okay, the third case, it might be happen that the monk has committed some offense against the rules, and then it becomes the duty of one monk to admonish him, to speak to him for breaking these rules. And so he thinks, let a monk who is my equal, that is somebody who is at my same level of seniority, admonish me. Suppose he's a monk who's has 10 years seniority, then he might agree to have a monk with 9 years, 11 years, admonish him. But if a monk, somebody who's been a monk for 2 years, starts to admonish him, then he thinks, what is this little youngster doing? He doesn't have any right to admonish a senior monk like myself. And so then he becomes angry and bitter. Okay, so these have to do with these three paragraphs, with the cases of a monk who commits offenses. The next ones have to do with ways in which a monk might want to see his ego blown up in front of others in public. So here a monk might think, oh, that the teacher, that's the Buddha, might teach the Dhamma to the monks by asking a series of questions of me, not of the other monks. So this is one of the ways in which the Buddha often teaches. You could see that he'll sometimes engage a monk in an exchange of questions and answers. And usually the Buddha will choose a knowledgeable monk so that he will receive the answers that he expects. And this is a way that the Buddha shows an honor to the monk. And so often the Buddha will ask the questions to Sariputta, to Venerable Ananda, to Anuruddha, one of the well-known monks. But here, this monk wants the Buddha to ask him the questions, so he'll be able to reply correctly, and then the Buddha will say, "Very good, Venerable Bodhi, very good, Venerable Bodhi." But then what happens is that the Buddha, when he's teaching, he asks other monks the questions, and they answer. And this monk becomes angry and thinks, "Why didn't the Buddha choose me to answer so that I could shine in front of all the others and get praise from the Buddha?" And so then he becomes angry and bitter. Okay, then it happens that the monks go together on alms round to the village. And generally when monks are going together to a place on alms round, according to the proper procedure, the monk who has the greater seniority, more years as a monk, should go in front, and then all of the other monks follow according to their year of seniority. It doesn't matter what their spiritual achievements might be. The senior monk might be not very well developed, not a great meditator, not very learned. But if he has many years seniority and is basically of good behavior, he goes in front. And a monk who might be fully enlightened but has 1 or 2 years seniority, he'll go near the back. Okay, but this monk here doesn't even recognize the principle of seniority. But he thinks when the monks are going into the village on alms round, he wants all of the monks to say, "Venerable, you are the best one amongst us. You should go in front, and we'll all follow you." And so when the monks go into the village on alms round in order of seniority, this monk becomes angry and irritated at the others. Okay, then this monk wants to get the best of everything. The best seat in the hall, the best water. I don't know how some water can be better than others. The best alms food. He wants to have delicious alms food. And this is all done as a token of respect to somebody. But if he doesn't get this, then he becomes angry and bitter. Okay, then it's the general practice when lay people come to the temple or to the monastery to make offerings of food, to make an offering of a meal. Sometimes before the meal, sometimes after the meal, one of the monks is chosen to give what's called the anumodana. Here it's translated blessing. It's not quite a blessing, but it's a kind of statement of, it means literally rejoicing with anumodana. So it's a way of expressing the appreciation of the monks to the lay people for their generosity, for their devotion in coming to make an offering of food to the Sangha. And usually the honor of giving the blessing is given usually to a senior monk who's somewhat knowledgeable and one who's popular with people. And so this monk wants to be the one always chosen to give the blessing. And if the assignment is given to other monks, then he becomes angry and bitter. Okay, then another honored task that shows honor is being chosen to teach the Dhamma, to teach the Dhamma to the monks, to teach the Dhamma to the nuns, to teach the Dhamma to lay people when they come to the monastery. And so this monk thinks, "May I be the one who's chosen, given that assignment of teaching the Dhamma, so everybody will look up at me and say, 'Ah, I'm the teacher. I'm the great knowledgeable one.'" But then when, I guess it's the Buddha or the senior monk of the monastery chooses some other monk to give the teachings, either to the monks, the nuns, or the lay people, then this monk becomes upset, angry, and bitter. Okay, then the next set of paragraphs, this monk wants to receive honor, respect, veneration from monks, nuns, and lay people. Paragraphs 25, 28, this monk wants to be the one to get the superior robe, to be offered a nice, well-prepared robe, to be given superior alms food. We've already had that. When people construct a nice dwelling place, he wants them to come and offer for him to live there, and so on. And so when he doesn't get these things that he wants, then he becomes angry and bitter. And that anger and bitterness, that's said to be a blemish. Okay, now Sariputta is going to draw a contrast in the next two paragraphs, the next few sections. In the section beginning 29, section 29, he takes the case of a monk who has not abandoned these evil, unwholesome wishes, these wishes for honor, respect, to be shown special consideration by the Buddha. Okay, and so a monk like this might be observing the various ascetic practices. Here Sariputta mentions some of what are called the duttangas. The duttangas are the ascetic practices that the Buddha allowed for members of the Sangha to undertake. Now, in the Buddha's time, many of the ascetics and contemplatives and renunciants believed that the way to enlightenment was through self-mortification, through inflicting pain and suffering on the body. And the Buddha rejected this and established what he calls the middle path. But there were certain modes of practice that were undertaken by some of the other ascetics that the Buddha allowed his own monks to undertake, not because the infliction of pain and difficulty on the body is itself directly the way to enlightenment, but because these practices, it said, are conducive to eliminating craving, to becoming content with little, to having few desires, to being easy to support. Okay, so one of these is called forest dwelling. That means that one dwells only in a small monastery or a hut in the forest and doesn't live in a temple or a monastery in a town or city. Those who make a strict vow of being a forest dweller will never even spend a night in a town or city, but they'll always live in the forest. Okay, a frequenter of remote abodes is similar to a forest dweller. The next is called an alms food eater. That means that the monk will subsist only on food that he gathers going on alms round from house to house. The monk will not accept food which is prepared in the temple or monastery. He won't accept invitations to go to houses to receive meals in houses, but he makes the vow, the determination. So often it can just be for a limited period, for a few months. Some will do it on a lifetime basis. Always to get food that's collected on alms round, going from house to house. The one now that comes after that, called the house-to-house seeker, is a special type of practice of going on alms round. Now, if one goes on an ordinary alms round, there might be some houses, and this would have been true in ancient India, where some people were very strict Brahmins, and so they would not give any food to Buddhist monks. And so when one is going on alms round, one makes the determination to go to every house, whether one receives food regularly from that house or not. If one has a more relaxed way of practicing the alms round, one knows that certain houses in a village that one is familiar with regularly give, and there are some people who give either poor food or they don't give at all. And so one might think, it's enough for me to go to the houses where I know I'm going to be given a substantial offering of food. But when one undertakes what's called the house-to-house practice, one makes the determination when one goes to this particular area on alms round, one will go to every house, whether one has ever received food there or not. And so sometimes it happens, as a case that I've read about where it might be legendary. There was a Brahmin house, and the monk observed this practice of always going on alms round to every house. And for years, the people in this Brahmin family never offered him alms food. Then one day, the monk was standing in front of the house. In fact, the people never even came out. They never seemed to acknowledge his presence. Then one day, after several years, the monk came to the house, and he was standing in front of the house. And the Brahmin head of the household came out and said, "Please move on, sir. We don't give to Buddha's monks. And then the monk said to him, "Thank you very much." Then the man said, "Why are you thanking me?" And then the monk said, "I've been coming to this house every time I'm in this area for so many years, and before you never even acknowledged my presence. Today you had the courtesy to come out and tell me to move on." And then when the man heard this, he was impressed. He thought, wow, these monks are very grateful even to be told to move on. Maybe I should offer something to him. And then he said, "Can you come and sit inside for a few moments, sir, while I look to see what I have available?" And the monk came in, and the man made an offering to him. Then the monk spoke some Dhamma to him and his family, and then they all embraced Buddhism and became Buddhists. Okay, then what's called the refuse rag wearer, or a wearer of rough robes. You see, in the Buddha's time, in the early period, the monks would always make their own robes by collecting pieces of discarded cloth. Often the cloth would be taken from shrouds that were used to wrap dead bodies, and when they were discarded in the charnel ground. And so the monks would cut the pieces of cloth, sew them together, dye them, and that would be their robe. But then at a certain period, some householders wondered if they could prepare the robes themselves, prepare them nicely, and then offer them to the monks. And then the Buddha allowed that. So that became known as householder robes, robes made by lay people. And so when this was allowed, then many, many lay people would offer robes to the Sangha. And so very few monks would continue to wear the rag robes. But this became one of the ascetic practices that some very strictly observant monks continued to follow, to use only robes that they make themselves by stitching together pieces of discarded cloth. Nowadays, one doesn't see this very often. Okay, so now, usually when the monks are observing these ascetic practices, they're especially admired and respected. But now, Sariputta says that if these evil, unwholesome wishes are not abandoned by the monk, and other people see them and hear about them, then even though this monk might be observing these strict ascetic practices, but still his fellow monks will not respect, honor, and venerate him, because he still is nurturing these evil, unwholesome desires within himself. Then Sariputta illustrates this with a simile. It's a simile of a dish, a bronze dish. It's a rather bizarre simile. Okay, so somebody brings a bronze dish from a shop, and then he puts into it, it's a beautiful, clean, bright, shiny dish, and puts into it the carcass of a snake, a dog, or must be part of a human being, part of a human body. And then he covers that bronze dish, puts a cover over it, and then goes into the marketplace where there are throngs of people. And people will see him carrying this bright, shiny bronze dish around. And they might ask him, "What are you carrying around?" Then he will raise the lid and say, "Look in and find out for yourself." And they look in and they see a dead snake, part of a dead dog, or an organ from a dead human being. And then they're filled with disgust, with loathing and disgust. And so that's the way people respond when there's a monk who is nurturing and retaining within himself these evil, unwholesome desires, even if he's observing the ascetic practices, which are like the shiny bronze dish. But if he has all of these evil desires in himself, then people don't want to associate with him. Okay, then Sariputta, paragraph 30, he takes the opposite case. Here's the case of a monk who abandons the evil, unwholesome desires. And even if this monk is not observing the strict ascetic practices, but is following a more lenient or relaxed way of life, he can live in a temple or monastery in the village. He'll accept invitations to go to people's homes. He will wear pre-prepared robes that have been offered to him by householders. But still, his fellow monks will honor, respect, revere, and venerate him, precisely because he's abandoned these evil, unwholesome desires. Then this is illustrated with the example of, again, it's the bronze dish brought from a shop, and people put clean boiled rice, and they put various curries and sauces into it, then cover it and go to the market. Then if people ask, what are you carrying about in that bowl? Then he raises the lid, and people look in and they see very well-prepared rice, different curries, and then they become hungry and they want to eat. Okay, at this point, Sariputta finishes his discourse, and then Mahamoggallana, who is his close friend, has been listening to the discourse, and then he gives a simile to illustrate the impression that this discourse has made on him. Okay, he relates some incident that had taken some place sometime earlier when he had gone into the city of Rajagaha on alms round. And then he noticed he must have been passing by a cart maker's shop, and there was a cart maker who was planing a fellow. What is a fellow? Does anybody know? Not another man. What is a fellow? I think it's the rim of a wheel. When carts would have wooden wheels, would be the rim of the wheel. I think so. I just realized I didn't look up this word in the dictionary. And this was part of Nyanamoli's translation, so I think I would use another word rather than fellow. A whole class of educated people don't know the meaning. So it's the outer rim of the wheel, and this cart maker is planing it. And standing next to him is an ajivaka named Panduputta. Now, what is an ajivaka? The ajivakas were another sect contemporary with the Buddha. They were a sect of ascetics. The Buddha differed with them on a number of important points. But here, their philosophy is not important. It's just that there's this ascetic named Panduputta is standing by watching the cart maker plane the wheel. And as the cart maker was working on the wheel, the ascetic, the ajivaka ascetic, would think he should plane the wheel in this part, this bend, this twist, eliminate this fault, and in that way the wheel will be without bends, twists, or faults. Now, Moggallana was very highly developed in psychic powers. Of all of the Buddha's disciples, he was the one who was outstanding in psychic powers. So while he was walking by, as the ascetic Panduputta was thinking these thoughts, Moggallana was able to read his thoughts and know what he was thinking. And Moggallana observed that just as the ascetic Panduputta would give rise to this thought, the cart maker named Samiti would do exactly what he wanted him to do, even though the cart maker didn't have the ability to read his mind. But it was just something happening spontaneously, probably because the ajivaka Panduputta is said to have been formerly the son of a cart maker, and so he would have been familiar with the process of making a proper wheel. And also Samiti, the cart maker, would have had the same training. And so they would have noticed the same faults in the wheel at exactly the same time. And so each time that the cart maker would do exactly what Panduputta wanted him to do, then Panduputta would speak up and say, he's planing this wheel just as if he could read my mind. And so Moggallana then goes on to say that here he's giving, if you think that all of the monks in the time of the Buddha were excellent and outstanding, then this passage will give you some another perspective on this. Moggallana says there are persons here who've gone forth from the household, from the home life into homelessness, not out of faith, but seeking a livelihood, because it's an easy way to live. to get food, dwelling place, and they are fraudulent, deceitful, treacherous, and so on. And he lists about 30 faults that would have been existing in the monks of that period. And then he says, the Venerable Sariputta, with his discourse on the Dhamma, is plaining out their faults just as if he knew my heart, my mind, with his own mind. So there would have been many monks there who want their offenses to be covered up, who want to be given special honor and respect in the midst of the Sangha, who want the Buddha to recognize them, who want to be respected and venerated by people, and yet they're of bad conduct, of blemished minds. And so Sariputta has been pulling out and mentioning their faults just as I observe them with my own mind. And then the next paragraph, he speaks about the monks with the good qualities, those who have gone forth out of faith, who are not fraudulent and so on, who are guarded in their sense faculties, who are established in mindfulness, fully aware, concentrated, who have wisdom. And when they hear Sariputta's discourse on the Dhamma, then they drink it in and they eat it, as it were, by word and thought. And then he illustrates this with another simile, that it's just as a young woman or a young man who's fond of ornaments might take a garland of flowers and then put them on top of their head. And so these good monks, when they hear this discourse, they drink it up, they eat it. And the effect of this discourse is that Sariputta is making his fellow monks emerge from the unwholesome and become established in the wholesome. Okay, and that is the end of the discourse. If there's any questions, then please feel welcome to ask. Yes, please.
In terms of
identifying. Blemish. Yeah. I would say that to some extent, but I would say it's not a blemish that one has to be acutely concerned with at the outset. Yeah, that disappointment would be a kind of blemish, because one is ideally supposed to have an attitude of equanimity when going an alms round. Some people will give abundantly, other people will give just a little, some people will give very good, delicious food, other people will give just scraps that have been left over. But it said ideally one is supposed to have the same equanimity towards what one receives, whether it's good, bad, abundant, or a little. And towards everybody, one is supposed to generate the thought of loving kindness. So when we go, well, here, don't do it, but in Sri Lanka, when we go on alms round, when people offer anything, we always say, Sukhi Hotu, may you be happy. And then we generate just, even momentarily, just the thought of metta, of loving kindness towards them. Okay, that's a good question. Okay, the question is, why should the person who is without blemishes and doesn't recognize this be more prone to heedlessness than a person who is without blemishes and recognizes that he is without blemishes? I would say the point is that the person who doesn't recognize that he's without blemishes is somebody who's not keeping track of his own mind, who's not being so observant of the workings of his own mind. And so when this person encounters what would be a subhanimitta, a sensually attractive object, the person is more likely just to sort of let the mind drift out and flow towards that attractive object. Whereas the person who is without blemishes and is aware of this is more likely to keep some vigilant watch over his mind. And so if he encounters attractive, enticing objects, he'll recognize that even though I might be without blemishes, but I still have this tendency or disposition towards them. So I have to be careful and restrain the senses, not let them become engaged with the attractive objects. That's the way I would understand it. Yeah. Suki? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And also unwholesome states that one of the three, they
Yeah. Are you sure it's? Yeah, it's actually, it's a different word. It's kopo. It's kopa. It's not koda. But I'd say kopa is very similar to koda. I didn't get the third type of anger that you mentioned. The anger here. Dosa. A dosa is hatred. Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah.
And then actually what we see in more outer place.
Yeah. Kopa. Actually, that's a good explanation. Yeah, because dosa, what's translated as hatred, is called one of the three unwholesome roots. So it's, you could say it's the root for all manifestations of anger and hatred. Then the coda, it's quite similar to kopa, but maybe it could, if we want to make distinctions, we could say it's anger as a purely internal state. You know, the anger that boils in the mind, or the mind boiling with anger. And then kopa has the sense of almost of something that explodes. Yeah, that's something that shakes. So maybe one could say that the kopa here, that anger and bitterness, that is the anger that comes to expression. Maybe. But I'd say one is cutting hairs, distinguishing between coda and kopa. But what strikes me to be as an important point is that the sutta, though it's saying that the anger and the bitterness are both blemishes, but earlier it said that the blemish is a term for the spheres of the evil, unwholesome wishes. So I say the primary sense of the blemish is the unwholesome wish, the wish if one commits some offense, some fault, not to be discovered, or not to be criticized in front of others for that fault, the desire to be shown special honor, consideration, respect, by the Buddha or by the other members of the Sangha. That is the primary blemish. And those are kinds of manifestations of greed, at least in the desire for honor, respect, veneration, is a kind of greed. Any further questions? George?
You mentioned like mind.
Yeah.
It's also like you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. One would also need right view in one of its aspects in order to know what states of mind should be regarded as blemishes. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's right view about what a blemish is. I would say that suttas number 7 and number 8, which list the different, what are called upakilesas, minor defilements. In 44, sutta number 8 gives a list of 44 unwholesome qualities. That could be a good list for checking. Mary had a question. Right, yeah. Right. I didn't say that it's less serious. I say it's what was pointed out first in the sutta as the meaning of the word blemish. It says, in section 9, it gives a kind of definition of blemish. Blemish is a term for the spheres of evil, unwholesome wishes. And so the first meaning of blemish are these unwholesome wishes. Then when these unwholesome wishes are frustrated, then one becomes angry and bitter. And that anger and bitterness then become the resultant blemish. But it's not that they're less blameworthy than the original blemish. They have preferential treatment, that's the good expression. The sense of entitlement, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's what they're all coming from, are these different ramifications of the ego mind. And that's why I also say that though this is discussed in the context of monastic life, but one shouldn't think that it's restricted there. At work, maybe a number of workers working under the boss, and you think, ah, I want the boss to single me out and to commend my work, but instead you might have done work very hard, the person next to you doesn't work so hard, but the boss, when coming around, looks at the other person's work and says, great job, and passes you up. Or students in the class, I remember when I would study something well, and I always want the teacher to call on me, but she always calls on me when I haven't prepared in advance. Then I'm embarrassed in front of all the other students, and I become angry and bitter. Yes, Suki? But here one shouldn't take the expression yata bhutang pajanati to mean recognizing in the sense of insight, knowing impermanent, suffering, non-self. But this is just being able to identify the blemish as a particular blemish, to recognize that state of mind as that particular quality of mind. Okay, I think we have to stop now. Okay, the next classes will be April 15th, and then the Tuesday after that, April 22nd. And I looked over the schedule of classes. It seems to me I had Majjhima number 15 and 16. 15, I mean, it's good to read it, but it doesn't really need so much explanation, I think. And similar with sutta number 16. I like to take a sutta that needs more explanation. So I will go to number 18. It's a very important, very rich, and somewhat difficult sutta. And this one will probably take two classes to cover, I think. So I might be able to do it in one class. Okay, but read it in advance. It's called the Honeyball Sutta. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. We share the merits with the deities, the nagas or dragon spirits, the fierce spirits, asking them to rejoice in these merits and to protect the true Dhamma, to protect the world, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodit chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.